Hey everybody, what's going on? Rob Cicerino here with another one of our off-season Survivor podcasts. Really fun off-season, I feel like, so far. And we've got another good one today because we're going to be talking with David Lay, who teaches sociology and criminology at Mississippi State University. And we are going to be getting into the sociology of Survivor and different things that we can take from Survivor that sort of reflect about life and vice versa. So I think it's going to be a fun chat with David coming up here today. Been a good week, too, I think, on the podcast. We did our big cast preview. Nicole and I went through all 18 people that are going to be competing in Survivor Co-Wrong. Less than 2 weeks to go until we get all started on that. In addition to News AF, I also chatted with Sally Ann Salsano, who is the creator of Jersey Shore, about what she's working on now. We checked in with Sophie. Plus, on top of that, we also did our big catch-up with Spencer Bledsoe, which was very, very fun to go through all of his experiences from Survivor Cambodia. That's currently up on robiswebsite.com. And then, of course, we are going to get into the Survivor Family Feud coming up on Friday night. But before we get into today's show, we've got a Valentine's Day right around the corner as the weekend is approaching. This is going to start to be that time when you need to be thinking about what you're going to do for your boo or your bae or even your brochacha when it comes to Valentine's Day, because Pro Flowers has everything you need for your Valentine's Day flower plans, because you're always going to come out as the hero on Valentine's Day when you show up with these flowers. And Pro Flowers does such a great job. This is a true story that recently I had gotten Pro Flowers for Nicole, and she was so impressed. She was like, boy, after 12 years, you finally figured out what kind of flowers I like. And I really didn't figure anything out. I just got it from Pro Flowers. But whatever it was, the multicolored roses, that really was, she's like, oh, you finally got it. You finally understand what I want. So now I know from now on what to get at Pro Flowers. Pro Flowers has those one dozen assorted roses in a free glass vase for just $19.99. And if you order this week, they'll throw in free chocolates too, or you can double down and double the roses for just $9.99 more. Go to proflowers.com and use the code REALITYTV. Pro Flowers is quick, it's easy, and delivery for Valentine's Day is guaranteed. Pro Flowers is also guaranteed to last for 7 days or your money back. You can't beat the price and convenience, and Pro Flowers takes care of all the details. You're the one that gets all the credit. So here's the only way to get this amazing Valentine's deal, including free chocolates if you order this week. Go to proflowers.com, click on the blue microphone at the top right corner, type in the code REALITYTV. That's reality space TV. That's proflowers.com. Click on the microphone and type in the code REALITY space TV. If you want to get this deal, you got to hurry. It expires this Friday at midnight. So that's proflowers.com, promo code REALITY space TV. So let's go ahead and get into our conversation with David about the sociology of Survivor. Of course, David teaches sociology and criminology at Mississippi State University, and he came up with the idea for having this conversation on the podcast. So let's go ahead and bring him in. David, are you there?
What's up, Rob? How's it going?
Very nice to talk to you. And could you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, so I am originally from Mississippi. I've lived here most of my life outside of a few years. I've been watching Survivor since season 1, episode 4, we'll say. And then listening to the podcast since One World, and just sort of have gotten into the world from there. Became a patron a while back, and really enjoying the community, and certainly you know, all of the Survivor-related and reality TV-related content from RHAP.
Okay, so what happened? What made the light bulb go off for you of, you know what, I need to talk to Rob about sociology in terms of Survivor?
It may have been in a patron cast, but you mentioned sociology, and I think at one point you mentioned maybe talking to Chuck Klosterman.
I love Chuck Klosterman.
Yeah, fantastic, and very sociological in his essays and his writing, though he's not a sociologist. He does a great job of sort of understanding things from a sociological perspective. And so I contacted you, and you sort of threw it out there. I knew that you had some time in January between the seasons where maybe you needed some content. And then I think a week after that, maybe even less than a week after that, is when you did the podcast with Boston Rob.
Yes.
And he made a couple of statements in there that were very sociological or social psychological that I really just thought were perfect. And so, you know, that solidified sort of some of the things that I wanted to talk about, at least where you know, some good places to start with this.
Okay. And in our correspondence, you had written to me about the quote that really sort of sparked this for you from Boston Rob. So let me play a clip. Let me go back to December 10th, 2015, talking with the great Rob Mariano.
You know, so their reality, you have to be able to see things through the eyes of everybody. It's like, I don't know if it was Descartes or Immanuel Kant, the philosopher that said, I am not who I am. I am who you think I think I am, you know, and that's like pretty profound, but it's true in Survivor. It's not who I think I am. It's not even who you think I am. It's who I think that you think I think I am, you know?
Okay, so David, that made a lot of sense to you?
Yeah, it did. That was a quote that I recognize. It's a little off, but not by
much. How dare you? How dare you, David? I should hang up on you right now.
I know. I would never tell the Rob that doesn't suck that. But
yes,
that's the case. But his point is well taken, and what he's saying after that is absolutely dead on. In sort of seeing our personalities reflected in the reactions of other people. So this is a quote from Charles Horton Cooley, who's a social psychologist, which is really wrote from a sociological perspective. And he said, I am not what I think I am. I'm not what you think I am. I am what I think you think I am.
Mm-hmm.
So what he's saying there is that, you know, we're not a product and our personalities and the way that we develop and the people that we become and certainly the ways in which we behave are not reflective solely on who we are innately or inherently, and nor are they entirely subjective from another person's point of view. So I'm not just who you think I am, but I am going to pay attention to the ways in which you react to me, and I will adjust my personality accordingly. So when someone say you have an interaction with someone and they're reaction to you is very negative. They shy away from you, or they walk away, or they won't make eye contact with you, or they laugh at you, or whatever that is, then you're going to internalize that reaction and adjust your behavior accordingly. So are you being too annoying? You know, maybe you forgot to brush your teeth that day, so they're not, you know, they don't want to stand too close to you. Whatever it is, we're going to sort of start looking for explanations as to why people are behaving in certain ways towards us. And so our personality will develop through that process. And so in the reality TV show world and the Survivor world, what Mariano is saying is that we can do that sort of, even in that 39-day period, people can see how people are reacting to them. What roles do they assume that person is playing? What behavioral characteristics that they assume that person has. And then if you're as wise as Boston Rob, and you're able to understand that that's the process, then you can sort of project project yourself in a certain way, so that not only do they think certain things about you, but they may also, think that you think certain things about them and behave differently in that context. So I know that's a lot, but that's really what he's trying to say there.
I just want to make sure that I understand this. So let's say I'm out on the island with, say, you know, I'm out there with Stephen Fishback and Jeremy. And Stephen Fishback and Jeremy think I'm annoying, okay? But I don't necessarily perceive it. Am I, and maybe I'm not even being annoying, because a lot of people say maybe that I'm not annoying. Am I annoying because they think it, or I'm not annoying until I know what their perception is and I'm trying to not be annoying?
Think of it this way, and this is going back to Cooley's original sort of theoretical point of view, but think of it, he calls this the looking glass self. So the looking glass being a mirror. Think about the way that your personality develops as if you were standing in front of a mirror. And so society, or the people that we interact with, are the mirror. And so we see, so you stand in front of the mirror, you see that your hair is messed up, or you see that, you know, you've missed a button on your shirt. And so you make an adjustment based on that. So the mirror is the reaction to you. And then your grooming, would be the reaction to that reaction. And okay, that is really how we become who we are. is through that process.
Right, because we would be somebody different if we didn't have a mirror. We would be feeling better about ourselves, but we are more insecure based on what we're seeing in the reflection.
Maybe, and maybe we'd feel worse about ourselves too. This works positively too. If people are reacting to you in a positive way,
right?
Then you're reinforced, right? So we can we can see it that way as well. But yeah, that's basically how it works.
So when we talk about the sociology of Survivor, tell me, what does that mean to you in terms of the game? Is this more from the perspective of how we watch it as a TV show, or how the players perceive it in terms of the moves that they make?
Well, there's something there either way. I think the interactions within the game, I think, are probably the most interesting things to look at from a sociological perspective. But and we'll come right back to that. But even the game itself and the idea of this is a television show, and how are people being portrayed on TV, and how much say do these humans have in sort of the way that they're going to be portrayed? There's something to that too. That's not something I really want to get too far into. I'd rather sort of talk about what happens in the game itself, because I think, especially going back to the Boston Rob conversation, he was talking about that, from a strategic standpoint within the game. So that's where I think the most meat is, and where I think it's really the most interesting is looking at those interactions and the characters and the things that have happened before the game, or the things that happened during the game that may affect the ways in which people interact.
So you feel like the experiences that people bring into the game are probably overlooked too much when we are talking about how players are interacting in the game?
I think probably so. I think we tend to see them, for the first time, in the preseason, just like we are now, for these new characters, or in the Corinne cast or whatever. And that's sort of our baseline, is we think that they start there, Beast Mode Cowboy notwithstanding, for some of us. But so we just sort of, you think they're blank slates, and they come in, and then we make up our minds about who they are. But there's plenty of instances in which, understanding somebody more deeply might help you understand why they make the decisions that they make. Why does so-and-so Denise swear on her kids? Why does
lunch lady Denise?
Lunch lady Denise, yes.
Custodian Denise.
Thank you. Yeah, China. So why did she swear? Why was it so important to her? The game was so important to her that she would be willing to do that. Why is Tony so concerned about people finding out he's a police officer, or Gary Hogaboom so worried about people finding out who he is? What are those types of motivation? You look at Shireen and the things that she had gone through in her life, or even Philip in Redemption Island, and sort of some of the things that happened with he and Steve in the racial arguments, and some of the feelings that he had had. They were certainly based on some experience that he had had in his life. And so the easy thing to do is just to say that those reactions were somehow happened entirely within the vacuum of the game. But in reality, most of the times these things, there's something else there. There's some sort of either within their personality or experiences in life that is possibly motivating them to sort of react differently than others might expect them to.
So all of these Survivor players come into this game sort of fully formed, where they have this rich backstory, which we are not really privy to yet. As Abby Maria said once in Survivor Philippines, I am baggage. And I guess the answer there is yes. I think what's interesting about a season like Survivor Second Chance is that we are sort of privy to much of the baggage, at least from their time on Survivor, that they come into in these games. So we have a little bit of a better sense of who these people are.
Absolutely. And I would say that if you look at, All Stars, you look at Heroes versus Villains, if you look at either the fans versus favorite seasons or Second Chances, any of these seasons where most of the cast are returning players, you do have a more, at least from an audience perspective, sort of a richer understanding of who the people are. A lot of that might be based on just the way they played the game before. And we'll talk about you and All Stars a little bit if we have
time.
Oh,
good.
I know you're aching to talk about that.
Can't wait.
That fits into it as well, where I think, most of, and I, another thing is that I think that this is in the way, a way in which this is changing is, you know, with podcasts and with you know, Gordon Holmes and you know, all these interviews that you can read and the in-depth sort of community that exists now that didn't exist back then, maybe to allow us to, you know, Twitter, of course, and social media that allow us to see inside people's characters a little bit more than we could have before, maybe makes a difference here. But overall, certainly the average viewer sort of is just starting assuming these people on some sort of a clean slate.
So we have a clean slate for all of these new Survivor players that we're talking about in this season. You said other than, of course, the Beast Mode Cowboy and I guess, you know, knowing people from the NBA or whatnot. But for the most part, this is a clean slate for us and for each other with these seasons. So how could we sort of try to figure out where their heads are at coming into this new season of Brain versus Beauty versus Brawn 2?
Okay, so I'm not a psychologist, and I think psychology maybe is the probably the most efficient route for sort of figuring those things out. But what we can look at from a social psychological perspective is some of the ways in which interactions, and we can notice these things on the first day. You know, people are able to make judgments on day one about people. And the ways in which they make those judgments and the ways in which they are, those judgments are internalized by the players themselves can sort of manipulate the way that player might play the game. So you can think of the concept of self-fulfilling prophecy, which if you're not familiar with, is this psychological principle primarily, but again, we also use it in social psychology, where we internalize the things that other people are saying about us or are telling us about ourselves, and then we react accordingly in order to become that thing. So, for instance, Rob, if you were, you know, when you were in middle school, if your favorite teacher told you that you were a great writer. Mm-hmm. And then you went home that night and you told your parents, oh, my teacher says I'm a great writer. And then you spend some time writing. And you know, the more you write, the more praise you get and the more, you know, and then therefore you write more and you focus on it more because, hey, this is something I'm good at. I should be doing it a lot. Well, in time you actually do become a great writer, even if you weren't really that great of a writer to begin with. So, you know, our behaviors and the way that we sort of prop ourselves up is a lot of time based on these things that people say about us or they tell us, whether verbally or non-verbally.
But David, isn't that something that can go the opposite way? Because as a parent, I've done some reading on things like this. And in some of the books and audiobooks I've listened to, they say, like, you shouldn't tell your kid that your kid is smart, because mm-hmm. then your kid like did something right. And you say, oh, you're so smart. But then the first time that the kid runs into something that they can't do easily that makes them feel like they're not smart, they don't want to do that thing anymore because it doesn't reinforce that label that they're smart. And they end up sort of like moving away from anything that's too much of a challenge because it doesn't jive with the notion in their head that they're smart. And they end up becoming not as smart because you've told them that they're smart and they don't want to do anything that makes them feel like they're not smart.
Right. And that's absolutely true too. And so this is not something I think you should do. I don't think everyone should say, okay, self-fulfilling prophecy exists, therefore I have to fill my kid's head with only positive things about themselves so that they will end up fulfilling this prophecy, so to speak. But this is a process that happens in more of a casual social way or sort of a subtle social way where we do internalize things, especially when they happen over and over and over again. An example of what you were talking about, I think a pretty good example is the, I can't remember his name, but the affluenza kid who's in the news, back mm-hmm. in the news again.
I think they just call him affluenza kid.
Affluenza kid. There you go. He spent his entire life or as much of it as he's lived, sort of thinking he was better than everybody and sort of being told that he didn't have to live within the rules of society, sort of experiencing that complete lack of connection between himself and everybody else in society. And that can happen that way. And that in and of itself is a problem. And you know, there might be some examples from Survivor in there that we might get around to in a little bit as well. But you know, so self-fulfilling prophecy is really this idea that if we're told something enough times that we, again, whether it's a good thing about ourselves or whether it's a bad thing about ourselves, in time we're going to start to focus on those and internalize those more and more and more. And even if they're not entirely true the first time we hear them, they're eventually going to affect us in a way that is true, and at least real in its consequences.
Now, is this something that you see on sort of a macro level in terms of the tribe delineations? For instance, okay, you're a tribe of heroes while you're a tribe of villains, you're a tribe of brains, you're a tribe of white collar people. Is that how you're seeing it? Or are there more personal ways in which that sort of thing manifests on Survivor?
Yeah. So this gets to something else that I want to talk about labeling. And this is a very similar process where, and we are given a label by society or by people that are close to us, and then we internalize that label. So again, it's very, very similar.
Is this like being the Rob that sucks?
It is. Yes, it is. And it's you know, in very much so. In All Stars, you were labeled for better or worse, whether you deserved it or not, as being a dangerous player, someone that was going to connive. One that was going to be able to move and move back and forth and sort of shift the direction of the game, which is, you know, well deserved probably from the way you played in Amazon. But there was no way that your tribe was going to assume anything else about you, that you were going to play along with them, or that you were going to whether you would have or not. You know, that label was affixed to you so strongly. That was assumed to be the truth about you. That has more to do not with the way that you played in the game, but the way that your tribe saw you in the game. In terms of the heroes versus villains thing, we see this a lot in sort of, okay, we're the heroes, we have to act like heroes. So we have to play with, you know, honor and integrity or whatever. Whereas the villains kind of maybe felt like they could be a little more underhanded and they could do these things that were more villain-esque.
All right, so if a group of people decide, okay, Rob is a big threat and, you know, he's a schemer or whatever, is there anything that I could do to change that perception, or now I just have to, this is my lot in life?
Probably, if you had been able to, you know, within the context of the game again, if you'd been able to stick around a little bit longer, you know, if your tribe had won another couple of immunities, or if there had been somebody else on that tribe that was perceived as a bigger threat, or somebody that was so annoying that couldn't be overlooked, then in time, you know, I think your behavior might have been able to prove, you know, otherwise. But initially, no, there wasn't. I don't think there was any way that you were going to go in there and in the first few days be able to convince them that. You turned over a new leaf and you weren't going to play. And I think recency probably had a lot to do with it as well. Mm-hmm. You know, I think over time we can sort of start to peel those labels away. We talk about labeling a lot in deviance when we study deviance and crime, and that people that may do something small time. You know, maybe they when they're a teenager they shoplift something minor, or they're known to sort of be a little mischievous in a way that's a little on the border of being a bad kid, but they get labeled with this label bad kid, or they get labeled with this label of thief or whatever it may be. And so people start to treat them like one. They start to tell them that they're a thief or they're a bad kid. They start to ostracize them in ways that you would for someone that you thought was not a very good person. And then that label is just reinforced through secondary deviance, through another act of deviance that, people think I'm bad, I must be bad, so bad people do bad things. And so you start to, you know, just like the villains, start to do more villainous things.
So then in terms of the people that are playing in the game, can you do anything to make this work for you in terms of labeling the other people? Should you be out there sort of with a label baby junior and just like sort of like, hey, I think this guy is this guy is this, she's this, she's this?
Yeah, I mean, I think you can. I think you could. I'm trying to think of an example of this because I'm sure there are some, but where we're on day one, you know, I've got a bad feeling about fish, right?
Yeah.
you kind of that you're planting those seeds, and those are little labels. Whether or not other people are going to agree with you or sort of allow you to do that or join in you in treating that person in a certain way, it probably depends on, you know, that person's interactions. But I think if you can kind of get that label affixed very early, at least in the minds of your tribe mates, I think that could go a long way in sort of having people at least start to question things. Cause then Fishback goes to get sticks and doesn't come back with very many. And suddenly, it's exactly what I said. I knew there was something suspicious here.
Right. Where if Keith Nail did the same thing, he doesn't have that label. Nobody, the alarm doesn't go off.
That's right. That's exactly right. And even Jeremy, you know, tried to do kind of the same thing to him, and it didn't work because, you know, Jeremy's personality was not seen as being as sort of as conniving and as Fishback's was.
Okay. So if there are labels that are out there, what happens if like multiple people have different labels for somebody? What if somebody looks at Steven, okay, he's the schemer, but somebody else looks at Steven as, you know, oh no, Steven's the loyal guy. He's the person who goes to the end. Like, how do we deal with multiple labels on the same person?
Again, it really would just come down to consensus. What do most people say about this person? You know, again, I feel like in All Stars you were, it was pretty much a consensus. Whether or not everybody wanted to vote you out first, you know, I don't know, but I feel like that everyone at least did think, you know, this guy's good, this guy's dangerous. So
we got to get rid of him at some point. Why not now?
Got to get rid of him. And you know, the longer he sticks around, we hear this over and over every season. The longer we let this guy stick around, you know, like Joe, you and Joe are basically the same. And
that's what I've been saying for a while now.
I know. I completely agree. You know, the longer we let this guy stick around, the harder it's going to be to get rid of him, whether it's because of challenge prowess or whether it's because of, you know, someone's ability to play the social game and really get people to like them and to listen to them and sort of, you know, appreciate their personality. In this case, it doesn't really matter what the reason is. That danger is danger. When that label is pervasive enough within your society, it becomes very difficult to overcome.
So, David, is all this information for you, is this something that helps you as a predictor of events? Or is this something that's sort of like in the autopsy of, okay, what just happened? It's like, okay, this actually makes a lot of sense based on what we know about these people to be able to tell after the fact.
Well, Rob, I've predicted the last 7 winners of Survivor.
Get out.
No, that's not true at all. I'm really bad at predicting these kind of things, actually. I think it helps you predict sort of interactions between people. I think it might help you sort of, yeah, I think especially with, in a second time player season, an all-star season, you might be able to sort of look at how people might interact with one another, whether, you know, positively or not. But in terms of like actually predicting gameplay, actually predicting, you know, who might do well or who might win a season, I think that's harder to do because, again, you're only seeing what CBS wants you to see, first of all. And second, you know, it's so hard to make any sort of grandiose understanding of who somebody is or how they're going to internalize something or how a tribe might interpret one small thing and just really blow it out of proportion. You really can't see those things coming most of the time. So I wouldn't say it really helps that much, but I think it really is an interesting thing. Now, I think it would help somebody in the game. I think it might help somebody that's actually playing the game to have an understanding of this and to sort of use it to their advantage. And that's kind of what Rob Mariano was talking about, is being able to understand the psychology of the game and then step back from that and sort of see it, as chess pieces and then move people around, and yourself included, and sort of project yourself in a way, put yourself in a position that you want to be in, and sort of handle things that way. I think it very much would be helpful in that respect.
So what's more important to sort of decipher from these other players that you're in the game with? Are you more interested in how they look at their philosophy on the game, or are you more interested in what their philosophies are in terms of their personal life or their life outside the game?
So this is interesting because I think this brings up some ideas about reality and what is real. And reality is socially constructed. We think of it as being, well, this is, you know, it's either real or it's not real. In fact, it, you know, society tells us and our culture tells us what is real. And our values tell us what is real, but those, you know, our values are entirely created by culture. And what society says is either okay or is not okay. So when you got two people coming to the game from very different parts of the country or very different types of families or very different, you know, political beliefs or things like that, they're going to have different realities. President Obama might be the best president of all time. He might be the worst president of all time. And to those two people, you know, that reality is just as strong. They're just as convinced of that truth, of that reality. Players sort of process things within their reality. Every not just players, everybody processes things within their own reality. And so when you experience something inside the game, whether that is, you know, Jeremy going off to the beach after Savage tells his, you know, story about his wife, the way that you interpret that is going to be in some way based in your reality. Fish seemed to, possibly because of his understanding of the game and his deep strategical love of the game, that goes strategy first. So how do I explain this action? The action is Jeremy leaves. So what are the possible explanations? Well, did he need to go to the bathroom? Was he going to go fish? Was he going to, fly away? Or did he get abducted by aliens? So we start with the things that make sense to us first. And at least according to what we saw on TV, the first thing that Fish thought about was he's going to look for an idol.
Mm-hmm.
The first thing some other people may have thought about was he was just really touched by this amazing story. He needs some time to himself. He misses his wife. You know, I don't think anybody would jump straight to, well, he must have been abducted by aliens, because that's not within our realities. So we would go through those. And then
the X-Files this week.
Well, there you go. So if we go through one thing and it doesn't make sense, well, he didn't go to look for the idol because, you know, I know the idol clue is in the woods somewhere, or I already have the idol, perhaps, maybe an explanation. Then you would move on to the next explanation that fits your reality. You sort of go through this Rolodex of, okay, what are possible explanations of this that fit my reality before you get to the things that maybe don't fit your reality. And we tend to usually land on things like, well, he just did it because he's crazy. If we can't think of any other reason that somebody did something, then we think that there's something wrong with them. We can't explain it. Therefore, it's, you know, it's not normal behavior. Yeah, and I think that's something that we possibly see too, in some, you know, maybe some arguments that have happened in the past where, you know, two people's realities didn't match up. So one person just assumed that that other person clearly isn't logical and clearly isn't capable of being normal or participating in this completely normal reality that they have constructed for themselves.
Right. But as confusing as that might be, even the person who we think is crazy does have a reason for what they're doing.
Yes. Right. And that that reason will always be found within their reality. Again, for Jeremy, it was that, you know, he was upset about, you know, he knew this thing about Val, that, you know, she was going to have another kid. And it was an emotional moment for him. And he did just want to get away and sort of reflect on that a little bit. You know, where that was on you know, Fishback's list of things, I don't know. Maybe it was number two, maybe it was further down. But yeah, of course, in our world, looking at our first person, you know, point of view that we all have, everything makes perfect sense to us. Because we're operating within the context of our own experiences and our own reality. So we don't ever question ourselves. I think when we start to question ourselves, there might be other things going on that are more serious. But we tend to sort of, you know, understand our own motivations more than we understand others.
What could we be doing to better understand motivations of people inside and outside the game that we don't understand?
Again, this is something that I think we're limited to some degree in what we actually see. But I think part of it is just making sure that we are cognizant of, you know, people's experiences and people's realities being different. And not just jumping to conclusions about whatever types of behaviors, you know, may be happening. And I think it's important to, you know, you certainly want to notice when someone is acting in a bizarre way. You don't want to be that guy that is, all the moves are being made behind your back because you're just assuming the best of everyone. But you don't want to be the guy that's assuming the worst of everyone either. So I think there's a balancing act that has to sort of take place there in terms of, you know, thinking about, you know, what do we know about Jeremy? Well, we know he's married. We know he loves his wife. We know he's a family man. We also know he is a strategic minded person. We also know that he is someone that really wants to win this game. So we have to balance those two things out before we make any sorts of conclusions. And again, I think either of those conclusions are valid, but you know, it just depends on the point of view that you're coming to that situation from and analyzing that behavior.
And how much of the perceptions that we have of other people are based on how we ourselves are? For instance, I've always read that the person who is the natural liar, the person who's inclined to lie, might accuse somebody else of lying quickly because that's sort of like how their brain works. Or the person who's a thief might accuse somebody else. The whoever smelt it, dealt it theory of thinking, where
that's right.
If I'm somebody who's like a kleptomaniac or somebody, well, I shouldn't say kleptomaniac, but somebody who is like I'm a cat burglar and something is missing and I didn't take it, I'm very quick to assume somebody else must have stolen it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it plays, that's a great question, because I think that plays a huge part in it. Again, if that is our reality, that we're a compulsive liar, and we know that that has gotten us places in the past, and that's the first thing that we would do in a given situation is lie or steal or whatever, you know, the situation might dictate, then we would assume that about other people. There's no reason that we wouldn't make that assumption about other people. You mentioned lying, though, and I think this is a really interesting thing as well, is that when we're trying to determine whether or not people are trustworthy, which of course is a huge thing within the game of Survivor, We look for clues to determine whether or not people are trustworthy, right? And this in everyday life as well, these sort of, whether it's language or whether it's nonverbal types of language, we try to look for these cues. So one thing that I think is well known is that, or well understood, for better or worse, is that people that lie a lot don't look you in the eye, right? That's sort of a common understanding.
Yes.
So what happens in practice, and that's definitely the case, I'm sure, for Dominic and for kids. But what actually happens is everybody knows that liars don't look you in the eye. So what do liars do more than anybody else? They make sure that they look you in the eye.
Ah.
Especially within the context of a game like this, where, you know, lying and deceiving is a big part of getting ahead. It's a really interesting thing. And what another, there's a study that was done on this exact behavior. And what it found out the research question was, you know, are these people deceiving you or are they not? Are they being honest or are they deceiving you? And the people that participated in the study, it was a crapshoot as to whether or not they could tell based on these cues, because the guessing was just as good or just as likely to predict, to be correct than actually trying to diagnose through these cues. So detecting deception is very difficult.
What about crotch framing? How much does that help?
crotch framing is probably beneficial for a lot of things, but not sure how much it helps in the trust category.
Yeah, Jeff Varner called it about Spencer. He said that watch out for the guy who's crotch framing.
He did. You can't deny the Varner.
He was onto something.
He was.
Could you talk about some of the specific players in Survivor history that you can spot something about them from their background?
Yeah. So there's a couple of things here, and some of these may just raise more questions than answers, but I think they're interesting to think about. I mentioned Philip and his blow up with Steve, and we mentioned Shireen, and I think everyone is pretty aware of Shireen's background and how that affected her in the game when she felt like she was being treated in a way similar to the ways that she had been treated before. And so her reaction to that was to feel the same way that she had been treated maybe in her life outside of the game. And so it's certainly very understandable from my point of view. But some other things, questions like, Abby Maria is a really good example. And if you go back to Philippines, there was a lot of, at least at one point, some talk about You know, she's not really a bitch. She's just, I'm just Brazilian, I think is what she said. Or it's just, it's a cultural thing.
Yeah, is it cultural?
It's a cultural thing. And basically she was just saying, you know, there's a language barrier. And so you're misinterpreting some of the things that I'm saying. Maybe we have different beliefs and values because we come from different cultures. So you're misinterpreting some of my actions. And that's what she was trying to say. When on the surface, it certainly just appears as if she was just being a bitch. Kind of what Abby is known for now, because of, again, going back to the labels. So what, you know, the question is it cultural or is it just her personality? And I think that there's probably, it wouldn't be surprising to me. And I would certainly think that there is something to be said from some of her cultural differences and maybe even from some of the ways that she interacted with others based on maybe not understanding things, whether those were, again, verbal cues or nonverbal cues. But there's a lot of it that's just based in her personality for whatever reason, whether that is, you know, how much of that maybe has been frustration with sort of assimilating to American culture, how much of that was the stress within the game. And, you know, Abby seems to be one of those people that's, you know, she's definitely a firecracker, mm-hmm. but outside the game seems to be a lot nicer.
But to me, I'm wondering if maybe, and when we're talking about it in this way, I wonder if it's not as much that people are misunderstanding what she's doing, but I wonder if she, because, you know, has English as a second language, I believe, is it more that she's misreading cues from the other people? So maybe it's not necessarily about her, like, misinterpreting her culturally, but mm-hmm. I wonder if, because, you know, you're in a game that's, you know, so conspiratorial, like Survivor, if she's not really, you know, picking up every single thing that's going on, is she in a more heightened sense of paranoia because of that?
I think that makes a lot of sense as well. Again, you know, her situation sort of being, so she's obviously looking at this game and looking at the world from her perspective, from her point of view, and all these things that may be happening around her that she is not interpreting. Now, that's not what she says, as far as I remember, but I think it's absolutely just as likely to be one as the other. And that's the kind of thing, you know, when two people are interacting, or when, you know, one person is interacting with a group, there's two sets of interaction, you know, the interaction goes both ways. You know, it might speak to how much of the people in that cast were willing to sort of, or were able to understand where she was coming from and how much trouble maybe she had with some of the nuances of the language. And again, this is all of this is exacerbated by the conditions and by the game itself. But yeah, I absolutely think that, you know, I don't want to sound like it, you know, oh, well, you know, poor Abby, all these people were misinterpreting everything that she did. I certainly think that, you know, it goes both ways, that she was misinterpreting the way that other people do things as well. You know, anytime we experience another culture, we misunderstand them, or we struggle understanding them as much as they may struggle understanding us.
All right. Who are some of the other players from Survivor history that you have some observations about?
Okay. So I've got a lot to say about Colton. I think that Colton is one of the, honestly, one of the most interesting players, from my perspective, that's ever played. And I won't say anything else on that, but I think that what's really interesting to me about Colton, and as particularly in One World, of course he was not around long in either season, but particularly in One World with his spat with Bill. So this is a guy. So I'm as you know, I'm from Mississippi. I've lived here most of my life, and this is a guy from Alabama who's gay. That's not always a popular thing here. Mm-hmm. That's not always something that goes over very well, at least, you know, for a lot of people. And I can only imagine, you know, some of the experiences that maybe he has had. And I don't know, you know, where he went to school or anything like that. But if he at all went to a public school, I would imagine that he experienced some trying times and some people that were rude to him. So he's a gay man. He's also apparently fairly wealthy. Mm-hmm. At least it seems like he is. So he's coming into the game with you know, the potential prejudice. And again, I don't know what he's experienced, but potentially some prejudices that he experiences that he has experienced, but also some privilege, right? In that he has lived a life of somewhat of wealth, and we certainly see that come across when he interacts with Bill, and not just on the racial issues, which I'll get to, but when he's sort of looking down at Bill for being a comedian, like that's the worst possible thing you could be.
Yeah, get a real job, he said.
Get a real job, exactly. You know, viewing the world from, you know, from that ivory tower sort of point of view. And then, of course, the racial aspect of it that gets brought into it, you know, where the only black person he knows is his housekeeper, which, you know, I think is one of the most poignant sentences in terms of summing up a character. Again, I don't want to speak to, you know, who Colton really is, but the character Colton on that first season, I think that sentence really sums it up pretty well, that this is the guy that he's going to be on this show for as long as he would be there. So, you know, I think he's a really interesting person because you can see both sides of it, where, you know, he's experienced some things that were difficult, but you also know he's had some privilege, and how those two things sort of interact. You know, he's gay, but you also know he's from the South. And I think we think a lot about, you know, social movements, and we think about, you know, injustice and social equality. We tend to group minority groups together, and whether that's racial minorities or, you know, gay and lesbian people into sort of these minority categories, and that there is some sort of correlation or some sort of shared experiences by them. And there probably are some, but I think this is a really interesting example of how, you know, you don't necessarily empathize with other people. Just because you're one form of minority doesn't mean that you necessarily have the breadth of experience or the breadth of culture to sort of say, well, I probably shouldn't be racist seeing as how I'm gay, because I, you know, these people might experience some of the same things that I've had to experience. So I really think Colton's really interesting in that way.
Yeah. And with Colton, I really do think that more so than racism, and again, I think that was regrettable what he said with Bill about how, you know, the only black person he knows is his housekeeper. I think that the disdain for Bill came more out of what you mentioned with his lifestyle. Like, it was much more classist, I felt like, than anything else.
No, I completely agree with you. I really do. I think that the comment about his housekeeper, I think, was after sort of race had already been brought into it. And I don't think he just said that off the cuff, if I remember correctly. But he laughed when he said it. And I don't think he laughed when he said it because he was being a jerk necessarily. I think he was kind of experiencing the irony of that as he said it. I think he kind of noticed it as he said it. So, I don't think Colton's racist. Do I think that he probably short-sighted in his view of the world in some ways? Yeah, but you know, I wouldn't think that he was out and out racist. But definitely the classism, I think, is the most interesting thing. And it was almost like, obviously there were some things that we don't know about, or maybe you do, but with some things that Bill was doing, pulling pranks or whatever, you know, throwing Colton's idol in the ocean, maybe at one point. That rubbed Colton the wrong way. But I think a lot of it really did come down to just differences in ways of seeing the world, different realities. You know, Bill, for better or for worse, sort of not a very serious person, not taking things too seriously, definitely from a different part of the country, and you know, having a lot of different experiences. Again, whether class, race, or you know, sexuality, experience in the world very different than Colton. And so, you know, that clash was, it made sense. You know, our abilities to get along with people that are different from us are going to vary. Some people can do it, some people can't. And again, you're in a situation, we can talk a little bit about sort of the manipulation of the game.
Well, speaking of the manipulation, just sticking with this now, is your point that you're saying that this is kind of a failure on Bill's part for his failure to see that Colton had this bias, and that Bill Posley should have been saying, okay, yeah, I do stand-up comedy, but, you know, I'm actually, you know, I'm about to get my MBA next year, and sort of like project himself to be somebody who is more in line with how Colton, who is kind of calling the shots in that group, how he would want somebody to be?
Yeah, you know, I don't want to say that I think it's his fault that he was treated poorly or that he was sort of, you know, judged in any way, but game theoretically speaking, Rob, there's something to be said for being able to overcome these kinds of things. And, you know, even if it's not his fault that this guy doesn't like him, even if it's not his fault that this guy may have preconceived notions about his occupation or his way of viewing the world, being able to adjust to that, especially, you know, again, within the context of the game where it's a numbers game, within the context of, you know, alliances and making sure that you're on the right side of the numbers and making sure that you're appealing to people enough to have them let you stick around. You know, there is something to be said for that. I think you would have to be careful about that. Again, whether it's his fault or not, you know, the way that you're perceived is going to become the reality. And when that reality is negative, you know, your time in the game may not be long lasting.
Okay, talk to me in terms of manipulation.
And what I mean by manipulation is just simply what we know, that the game is contrived, that people aren't really shipwrecked. People are in front of cameras the entire time. You know, it is a show, and it is a set of circumstances that is, you know, conceived of by the producers. And so the ways in which they choose to do that can make a big impact on the way that people behave. Again, you know, Abby Maria, would she have acted the ways that she acted if she wasn't as hungry as she was, or if she wasn't, you know, as bored as she was? You know, we see a lot of times people do things out of boredom, or so they say. You know, Stephanie LaGrossa, I know you guys, you and Josh gave her a hard time on the evolution of strategy for her love of pizza. Mm-hmm. And in fact, you know, in Palau, she could have stayed around longer had she not been so damn hungry. She you know, left an immunity challenge for pizza. And, you know, people do crazy things for food, as you know, in situations where food is sparse. And people might do crazy things for luxury or for a good night's sleep. And I think that really, so all these things that we're talking about the ways that people behave within the context of this manipulated environment, and certainly within the harsh context of the ways in which, you know, people are starving and people are, you know, experiencing days and days of rain, as we've seen several times, people's fuses are going to shorten very quickly. And those sort of visceral types of reactions are going to come out in the ways that people might react to one another. The tolerance that we have for other people is going to be shortened without a doubt. And that may affect gameplay, again, like it did with Stephanie, or like it did with Varner in his first time out, maybe might have stuck around a little longer if he hadn't gone after the peanut butter.
So what does that say to us about how somebody handles the shortage of food?
It shows us how reliant our minds are on being nourished and our abilities to sort of function. And I don't know how sociological this is necessarily, but, you know, our abilities to just sort of maintain order within the ways in which we interact with other people. I think everybody's experienced being really tired, and either, you know, I know when I get really tired, sometimes I, you know, especially when I was a kid, I would get really deliriously giggly and happy, and then at some point I would hit a wall where I was just angry and mean if I didn't mm-hmm. get enough sleep. And I think that we see that in Survivor, that the starvation of, you know, in terms of nourishment, and the starvation of sleep and of comfort and even of entertainment really can affect the way in which people are willing to compromise with one another and are willing to again, going back to Philip, that whole argument started, if you remember, because of the rice got contaminated. The Ometepe's rice got contaminated, and they wanted to put the rice that they were able to save in the Zapatera container.
Yes.
And that's how that argument started. So, you know, the starvation and the fear that food might not be as readily available as you want it to be can really bring out the worst in people.
And does that stem from their background, or is that their metabolism, or it could be anything?
Well, I think everybody's going to react a little bit differently. And I think, you know, I think a lot of survivors have talked about, and probably you, I know you have talked about preparing for the game in terms of, you know, what you're going to eat and how you're going to eat in the weeks or days leading up to the game to sort of prepare your body for that. You know, you definitely don't want to go through something out there that you've never experienced before. You don't want to go through hunger if you've always had enough food to eat. You know, if you're Shane Powers, you know, you probably don't want to go cold turkey the day you leave for the game. That might not be the best idea because of the emotional or physical toll that it's going to take on you. And anytime you're in discomfort, you know, if I'm sitting in your studio right now in your apartment, Rob, just constantly pecking you on the top of the head, you're going to lose your concentration probably.
That's
over
right.
a period of
Knock
time.
Knock it off.
You're probably
Knock it off, David.
Going to get pissed off and frustrated, right? Because you're uncomfortable. Something's happening that's not okay. And so the way that we interact, that we deal with that. However, you know, if you are from a family of you know, 16 kids, and you were constantly sort of around other people, and you were used to people talking constantly about, you know, God knows what, flatulence or chocolate or whatever, going back to season two, it might bother you less because you're used to it. There's some sort of environmental comfort that you feel with that thing that might be uncomfortable to someone else. So someone that's, you know, an only child or doesn't have a lot of people around him or her might be really annoyed by some of those things right off the bat and have less tolerance for that. So, you know, there are environmental factors there, and there's something to be said about, you know, how many people we're connected with and in what ways are we connected with them back home and sort of how our lives, you know, are outside of the game.
David, could you talk to me about the presence of religion in Survivor? Because I feel like that's something that is a very big part of our everyday society. You know, people that are, you know, practicing, people that are, you know, don't want any sort of religion in their lives, because I feel like I've seen it on Survivor be something that's like a very big part of somebody's success. And then I've also seen where it has cost a player their game because it is something that really has been a turnoff for people.
Yeah, and this is something I've thought about too. And it kind of goes back, you asked about, you know, Bill. Should Bill have done a better job of sort of at least pretending to be somebody else? So Lindsay in season 30 sort of had this spat with Mike where, you know, he was religious and he had this tattoo and she was very outspokenly not religious. And that caused a problem very quickly after, and she was gone not long after that, where, you know, she didn't have to, it's fine to not believe the same things he does or to, you know, have whatever beliefs or non-beliefs that you have. But when you know somebody, something is very important to somebody, it doesn't make any sense to intentionally rock that boat. You know, you have to, even if you think you're right, again, even if your reality is such that there's no question to you that, you know, God is a certain thing or that God doesn't exist, to rock that boat is just asking for trouble. And, you know, we can see this, we can go back, you know, lots of, you know, Roxy, original Matt Singh member, was gone fairly early. And I think the show doesn't really, if I remember correctly, not really say that she was gone because of her religious beliefs, if I remember correctly. But I know Denise was kind of like, okay, she's speaking in tongues. That's a little much. Mm-hmm. You know, for Denise, that was a bridge too far, the speaking in tongues and sort of, you know, you know, Russell was pretty religious on that tribe too. But, you know, I think for her, it was just a reason to kind of prioritize getting her out. I think the best example may be going back to South Pacific and Coach, right? Brandon Hance and that entire tribe most of them seem to be very religious, to the extent that I don't know what Coach's religious beliefs are, but he definitely was, you know, had no shame in at least going along with the motions there, which was very smart of him, whether he believed it or not. You know, and he definitely caught a lot of flack over the incident where he, you know, prayed for the idol while he had the idol in his pocket.
Yeah.
Which may have been, you know, a little bit too much in the eyes of some religious people. But
well, how about when he prayed to God to tell him who to vote for? And
yes,
you know, exactly. And at least that's what he told Brandon. He's like, I prayed to God, and God said I'd vote for you.
Yeah, you know, it's not too far from you know, some things we've seen before where people, you know, praying to, you know, the guy from Redemption Island, Matt Elrod. Matt Elrod, yes, thank you. Was very religious and prayed to, you know, I think he prayed that, you know, he would win the duel at Redemption Island, or if, you know, if it was God's will, he would be able to win the duel. So we've seen that kind of thing before, where people at least allude to God helping them in some way, or God favoring them, or at least hoping that he will favor them in some way as we go through, as they go through the game and sort of have to make those decisions and have to you know, cross those bridges that might be very difficult. So it's an interesting thing. And I think people, you know, even people on the jury sometimes use, if they don't use religion overtly, then they use religion in a way that religion has such a major part of our culture. Culture is what tells us what's right and wrong, right? So culture is what, part of culture is values. If there is a dominant religious belief, and in the U.S. that would be Christianity, then culture is going to reflect that. And so the values that are present in Christianity are often present in the values of our society. So we see, you know, that reflected in the game as well, where even if it's not overt religion, then the values that are associated with religion are often used to judge other people, whether it's okay to swear on your kids, you know, whether it's okay to lie about certain things, whether it's okay to betray an alliance. So religion's really a big part of the game, even when it's more subtle. It's a huge part of the game.
Now, Survivor has been on the air for 15 years now. We're heading into season 32. Do you feel like this 15-year span of Survivor has been any sort of accurate reflection of our own society in the United States?
Absolutely. And so here's the thing about, and this is something that you know, I've just within the last week that I've talked about in my classes, is that the idea of media and how media works. So does media reflect culture back to us, or does it actually affect our culture and the way that we see the world? And it's a really interesting question, and it's a bit paradoxical, right? Especially when you understand that the answer to that is that it does both. It both reflects who we are as a society. It reflects what our values are and what our culture is, but it also creates culture. It also tells us what we should and shouldn't be doing. And that may change over time. And we certainly can see that in such a long history of this show, where we can see, you know, changes in culture. And I think in terms of Survivor, I think it probably does more of the reflecting than it does of actually changing thing. I don't think there are any major sort of social changes that have come about because they were presented on Survivor. Though certainly, you know, there are other types of media where, you know, anytime that bias exists, you're going to see that reflected in the media. And what you're always going to see in the media is the dominant culture being presented more frequently. You don't have to go back that far to see, you know, where you could have watched TV every night and not seen any black families or not seen any black main characters even. You could go back not very far and not see any gay characters on TV, though you're starting to see that change. Now, one thing I think is interesting about in terms of the evolution of the cultural reflections that we can see in the game, if you go back to season one, you know, and Rudy's, you know, his hard cues that he drops a few times there, that at the time were just, you know, oh, that the guy's, you know, he's fine. The guy's funny, Rudy. You know, he's dropping the
America's, you know, sweetheart.
Yeah, absolutely.
Besides Colleen. Yeah. And most popular player that season.
Yes, yes. So, yeah, besides the fact that, you know, Rudy kind of got a pass because he was military and he was old, even if he hadn't have been. I mean, well, look at Sean Kniff, right? Mm-hmm. He was parroting back what Rich had said with the you know, FNF.
Yeah.
But it's still,
I don't know if that, even in, you know, August of 2000, if anybody was coming off and saying like, boy, Sean Kniff, wow, that's what a cool guy. He's like, he nailed it. Final tribal council.
And that's not what I'm trying to say. I'm not trying to say that it was, you know, it was a character.
It was on the show. It was aired on television.
On the show. It was aired. Exactly. I mean, it wasn't outside the realm of things that we saw on TV then. There certainly, you know, that word was in media and on TV, you know, if not on a regular basis, at least occasionally. So it by no means was unheard of. Now there's no way. There's no way you're going to see that word on broadcast television. No chance. You know, another thing Survivor has kind of done is sort of capitalize on things that maybe tell us something about the world we're living. Again, season 30, sort of this class-based season where, you know, you've got white collar, blue collar, no collar, which essentially could be translated into, as Jeff said, the haves and the rule makers, the rule followers, and the rule breakers. But essentially, it's a class thing, right? It's the working class, the upper class, and the I don't know if you really call the no collar tribe lower class, but sort of the free spirited sort of people that don't fit within those categories as well. And I think that reflects a lot about some things that people believe about the divisions of classes today. And we've certainly seen, you know, with Cook Islands, we've seen, you know, that sort of done in a different way with the divisions in races. Doesn't always work out as well as others, but, you know, I think it's an interesting thing to kind of look at, especially if you look at the long history of the show and sort of how things not just have evolved from a strategical standpoint, but have evolved just as it, the show is, you know, how, as it exists.
Yeah.
As a medium.
But I do think that to some degree, I don't think that's really an accurate reflection of the society in some way, because again, it's not like that, you know, different areas of the country are sort of, you know, electing their most representative people to go out onto the show. It's really, here's a group of people that were selected by TV producers for what they believe is some sort of a reflection of the world that we live in. So I feel like it's maybe some sort of funhouse mirror reflection of the world that we live in, but does not truly reflect what it's actually like to be a citizen of the United States of America.
Right. And no, there's not a lot of media that does. Right. And I think, you know, I've seen people, you know, online, people from other countries asking about what the U.S. is like, and is it like this movie or is it like that movie? And it's not like any movie, you know, it's so diverse. And, you know, L.A. and, you know, Miami are different places and have different types of people. And the experience there is going to be different. And the environment is going to be different. So, you know, to ask a show in 16 episodes to, especially a show that is not filmed in the U.S., to accurately reflect on a large scale U.S. culture, you're not going to get that. But what it does do, I think, with sort of, you know, the seasons that they air or sort of the in some way the ways that they've divided tribes, at least in a couple of instances, and the ways that they sort. Yeah, if you go back to Marquesas, which I think was the season that filmed right after 9/11, you can see a reflection of what that was like. And certainly in the finale, when Jeff takes his journey with the urn back, to New York, and that was the one was at Central Park, right? That was the Rosie O'Donnell.
Yes.
There's a lot of sort of New York centric, America centric sort of themes. I think somebody has an American flag as their luxury.
Pascal.
There you go. Of course, it's the epitome of a luxury item.
Yes.
so you know, you can see kind of the larger world reflected in it. Yeah. No, it's not reflecting the entirety of society, but you can see these little elements that exist when you know, as a time capsule. If you go back and watch an episode from 14 years ago, you're going to see probably something, whether it's language or whether it's a reference to something, or whether it's even the clothing that they might be wearing, that's going to reference what culture was at that, you know, in that snapshot, that period of time that episode was filmed.
But to drill down a little bit more, so if Survivor is not a true representation of what it's like to be an American, is Survivor a true representation of what it's like to be in a group, any group?
Yeah, so is it a true representation? Well, all groups are different. You know, groups have purposes, and groups are going to have, you know, different makeups depending on what type of group they are. But what we can see about Survivor when we look at groups is, you know, what do these groups, these tribes, or these alliances, what do they say about, the composition of the group and how that group forms, how that group and whether that group stays together and how that group sort of works within the context of the game. And so what we see a lot of the times, and again, especially in these seasons where they're told something, okay, you're white collar, you're no collar, or in Cook Islands, you know, you're the Asian American tribe and you're the African American tribe. You know, that lack of sort of diversity just right off the bat, I think tells us something about, or lets us see something about, you know, what group life can be when there's no diversity. People tend to segregate themselves on a lot of different ways. So if you have a group, if you have a tribe, as we would have in most seasons, where there's a few women and a few men and a couple of minorities, and, you know, maybe a gay person, then they're going to tend to not focus on those aspects, though they might sometimes. They're usually not going to focus on those things too much, and they're going to connect on different things. They're going to connect on more things maybe that are related to the game or related to any experiences that maybe they have in common. When you get a group, in Cook Islands where all the groups are, you know, homogeneous in terms of their makeup, you know, the reaction to that I think is interesting. And I went back recently and watched the first episode of Cook Islands, and you know, the way that those groups deal with that on day one is really interesting, because the Asian American tribe, and I don't remember the tribe names, I apologize, mm-hmm. but they, you know, you had Cowboy, who's making jokes about rice and making sort of all these sort of offhanded comments about being Asian. And so some of the others on the tribe were just, you know, let's not talk about this. Let's not become, you know, Yule specifically says, mm-hmm. I'm really worried we're going to become stereotypes.
Well, he didn't want to do the show when he found out what the theme was going to be.
I've heard that. I've heard there was a lot of things that went on behind the scenes there, at least partially in response to this, tribe divisions. And then you get the African-American tribe, and they're sticking together. They understand their shared experience. By the way, going back to the Asian tribe, an interesting thing about we think about race, we think about white, black, and you know, the Hispanic and Asian American, just to use those four examples from that season. Asian Americans and Hispanics in particular, there's nothing. That's a huge, huge group of people. Mm-hmm. There's no reason for us to think that someone from Taiwan and someone from Vietnam or someone from Japan have anything in common.
Wait, what? Hold on a second.
Exactly.
You're saying not every Asian person is the same?
Believe it or not.
What?
Believe it or not, Rob.
Everything I know about life is destroyed now.
I know. And so that was an interesting thing too. You know, that just in and of itself. And of course, the African American tribe, there's much more solidarity and there's that feeling of shared experience. And you know, I don't have it written down, but they make a couple of comments about, you know, kind of doing it for the team, and the team not meaning the tribe, but the team in that case meaning their race. And there was that sort of feeling of solidarity and of performing well for that reason. And then, you know, Ozzy on the Hispanic tribe and Billy Garcia, you know, they kind of see the world a little bit differently. Billy Garcia is talking about coming over on a boat like his grandmother did, or his grand, whatever it was, which is, again, kind of a what moment. And then
he's got a few of those.
Yeah, he does. He does. Oh my gosh, that guy. Oh, I miss him.
he's still so with us. Guy,
so then on the white tribe in perfect white form, everybody's just like, oh, we don't see this as being a racial thing, and because
that's
white people
right.
don't see race.
We don't see color. Yeah.
Oh my gosh, that just made my day, Rob.
Well, you know, I feel like we're onto something interesting that I've never really thought about before, yeah. about this idea of, does Survivor accurately portray to people, like if you were an alien coming to this planet, what is it like to be in a group where you're dropped off with eight people? Is Survivor an accurate representation of what that's like in any given situation, whether it's an office or whether it's a club? And I kind of get the sense that it is. And as we're having this discussion, I feel like that it might also be a representation of what it's like to be a minority or to be one or two minorities in a group where you are outnumbered by people who are, you know, the white people in that group. I feel like that might be a good representation of what that might feel like, which I feel like that Survivor might provide an accurate representation, like Sean and V, how they're feeling in that tribe in Marquesas, where they're the only two black people there and there are six white people in that group. The way they're feeling is probably an accurate representation of what people might be feeling in other similar situations that aren't Survivor.
I absolutely, and again, I'm with you. I don't, you know, I haven't experienced this, but I absolutely believe so. And I think that, you know, there's no way, you know, I think the other people on that tribe, you kind of had this mentality similar to in the Cook Islands. Oh, no, it's fine. We don't even recognize you that way. We're not thinking of it that way. We're not focusing on that. And maybe they weren't, and they probably weren't, but the reality of the world, is, you know, that's not the case, right? We have minorities, we have divisions in race that we have created. These are social constructions, but they're still real. They still have consequences. They still affect the way that people live in the world and that people view the world and people feel like they're being are being acted upon and feel like they're being acted upon. Yeah, in that case, the Sean and V situation, I think, very much was a possible reflection of what a real life situation similar to that would be.
All right, David, is there anything else that you've been able to take away from your study of Survivor that tells us either about how the game is played or about the society that we live in?
So just one more thing that I think is interesting, and this has to do with sort of with alliance building. And alliances are at the heart of this game, obviously. And you know, understanding the ways, you know, speaking of groups and understanding the ways in which we organize ourselves into groups, and in this case, organize ourselves into specific groups based on our own best interests. You know, it's interesting to think about the how strong these combinations are. So, in a situation where you have three people, let's say you've got Wanda, who is in alliance with Penner, and then Wanda's also in another alliance with Tony Vlachos. But Penner and Tony are not in an alliance, right? So Penner and Tony talking to one another and sort of overthrowing Wanda at the head of this alliance, this is so ridiculous, is probably not going to happen, right? Because the social dynamics between the two men in that situation are not such that would be likely to happen.
No.
But if Tony, Wanda, and Penner, so what you've got there is you've got two different connections.
I feel like this is your impression baiting me.
I kind of am. Yeah, it's true. I shouldn't have done that. I actually had this already written down, so on the fly. But anyway, if you have three people that are in an alliance together, and one leaves that group, then suddenly, you know, you don't have a person like Wanda who now, say Tony goes, you don't have... Wanda would be able to just kind of rely on Penner, and then they would go, you know, have their other people maybe in that side of the alliance. Where if they're in the alliance together, if it's just those three, even though three is not a bad number to have, if Penner's gone, the other two are screwed.
You're screwed, right? Without me, Tony and Wanda. Trust me.
And then one more thing in the same sort of vein. This is surreal to me, Rob. You know, one more thing in this same sort of vein is the more people that are in an alliance, the more possibility you have for interactions. And that's where I started, was talking about interactions and these sort of interpersonal relationships. And so, you know, if you have three people, if you have Jeremy, Spencer, and Tasha, just to use last season, then there's three possible relationships there. There's Jeremy, Spencer, there's Jeremy, Tasha, and there's Tasha, Spencer. If you add one more person to that, so let's say you add Fishback to that, then suddenly you've got six connections. And so the numbers start to increase exponentially. You add a fifth person, you've got four or five other possible ways that it can go. So the difference in three and five is huge in terms of the interactions that you see, in terms of the ways that people can build relationships or relate to one another or argue amongst one another even. And so that's sort of an interesting thing in the numbers and sort of the ways that these groups sort of form on the game and within the tribes, that I think is kind of an interesting to think about and look about. And we see this a lot where, you know, people talk about, well, I'm, you know, this person's my number one, but this person thinks they're my number one. And then there's this person. You know, the more people I think that are involved in those groups, the more dynamic it can become, and the more sort of socially interesting those interactions can become.
All right. Well, David, this has been a very fun conversation. I feel like we've learned a lot about Survivor. We've learned about life, and we've learned about sociology. Job well done.
I appreciate it, Rob. I really appreciate you having me. This is fantastic.
David, if people want to reach out to you on Twitter, what's the best way for them to get a hold of you?
They can find me on Twitter at David Lay. That's L-A-Y. And I don't tweet a ton, so I'm not going to bog you down, but we can talk about Survivor. We can talk about Big Brother Canada coming up.
Yeah.
And we'll have some fun.
Well, I'm sure we could do a whole podcast on the sociology of social media.
Yeah, absolutely. Very, very much so. Yeah,
as it pertains just to Survivor, even.
Yes. No question about it. It's the sociology of Eliza, on social media. So, yeah, that could be fun too.
All right, David, since sociology is probably hard to spell for a lot of people, why don't we go with, let's abbreviate this for the hashtag. Let's go social game.
That works.
Russell Hantz, his social game is on point. He always says, social game. That's what we studied here today.
That makes sense to me. I like the use of that.
All right. Well, David, thank you so much. And we do appreciate all your time and good stuff today.
I appreciate it, Rob. Thanks for having me.
All right, everybody. There you have it. David Lay here on the podcast. And very interesting, thought-provoking conversation about how sociology plays into Survivor. Okay. I told you at the top of the show, everything that we did this week, and if you missed any of that, especially the Spencer interview or the cast preview, you should definitely check that out over this Super Bowl weekend. We've got another great week coming up. Of course, we're still going to get to our Family Feud this Friday night. We're going to be streaming that, but if you miss it on Friday Night Live, you can catch it in the archives. Plus, we're going to get into such a big week next week. Of course, I mentioned Valentine's Day at the top of the show. Last year, we did our special love cast with Francesca. She is going to be back this week to answer your questions about dating and relationships. She's going to be in the studio with me coming up next week. Speaking of in the studio, her buddy from Survivor, Cara Moen, Corinne, is going to be coming by the podcast next week. We're also going to be having Angie Kontz stopping by, first of two preseason podcasts with Angie Kontz as we get ready for Survivor Co. Wrong. So much still to do to get ready. It's going to start to be, once we get through the Super Bowl, the heat is really going to start to be on as we get ready for Survivor 32 coming up. So hope you guys enjoyed the show today. Looking forward to reading your comments on robhasawebsite.com. Make sure you subscribe. Don't miss any of these shows. Go to robhasawebsite.com/iTunes or search for Rob as a Podcast in your favorite podcatcher. Have a great weekend, everybody. We'll talk to you soon. Bye.